Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. The last-minute appropriations passed by Congress is still being digested, but the bipartisan deal has GOP firebrands vowing to oust Mike Johnson, even as the speaker promises to pass the Ukraine supplemental so America keeps its global word. Vladimir Putin blames the ISIS-K terror attack in Moscow on Ukraine. Russia refuses to explain why one of its missiles entered Polish airspace, as Sweden's foreign minister calls for a tougher stance on Russia. Despite new trade and cyber tensions, U.S. CEOs were feted in Beijing by Xi Jinping. China is pressuring the Philippines, even as Manila and Washington ink a new security pact. U.S., Japanese, and Korean officials prepare for a new summit. And America abstains on the latest UN ceasefire call, prompting Bibi Netanyahu to call off his Washington visit and press ahead with the Rafah ground assault. And Washington and the world mourns the sudden passing of former vice presidential candidate and Senator Joe Lieberman. Joining us today, as they do every week to discuss all this and more, are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, Michael Herson, the president of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon Europe chief Jim Townsend, who is now with the Center for a New American Security and a co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the transatlantic alliance, now doing his annual stint at Sciences Po in Paris. So he's joining us very late at night as we are recording this on Thursday evening. Because of the Easter weekend holiday, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations, who is also joining us very, very early in the morning, his time. Everybody, thank you very much for making time. Michael, and of course, just before we get started, a quick program note. We are taping this on Thursday. This program will be on Friday morning, and we will be back on Monday when the Business Roundtable convenes in order to give everybody a nice holiday weekend. And then we resume our normal schedule on Tuesday with the Look Ahead podcast and so on. We'll be back at our normal time next Friday. Michael, as you always do, you join us for an update. And last week, as we were recording the show, literally in the last minutes, the motion to vacate was pressed ahead by Marjorie Taylor Greene. Walk us through where we are on this, right? Because you were right that the speaker was committed to passing a Ukraine aid package as quickly as he could to navigate the politics. It looks, as you also suggested, that Democrats would back the speaker to keep him in office, to keep additional craziness from happening, but also the legislative train moving. And the speaker has shown a degree, depending on the interpretation of bipartisanship, to try to get this legislation done. So walk us through first what the whole appropriations process that we went through tell us and the political dynamics around it, because as usual, there was a lot of chicanery. Right. We're happy we have an appropriations now, but it did come 6 years in 6 months, excuse me, into the new fiscal year.
Right. So it was incredible how much happened right after we finished taping on Friday. So they hadn't passed the minibus out of the House yet. And it was questionable whether they had the votes to do it or not. And they did. It did pass 286 to 134, which by passing on suspension was really close. So 101 Republicans voted for it. 185 Democrats voted for it. 112 Republicans voted against it. So more Republicans voted against it than for it. And it included, you know, 8 of the committee chairmen in the House and 16 members of the House Armed Services Committee, including the chairman, Mike Rogers, voted against the measure. The reasons we talked about last week, some of the things that people were upset about, which were included in other bills outside defense. The Senate did vote early Saturday morning, around 2 o'clock in the morning, to pass the minibus 74 to 24. They had to go through the whole rigmarole and charade of voting on amendments, knowing that these weren't going to pass, but people were insisting on these amendments, the border security, transgender stuff, and crap like that. So they got through it, the president signed it, and we are done and on to FY25. Now, as you mentioned, and as we talked about last week, Marjorie Taylor Greene did file a motion to vacate because she was upset about this $1.2 trillion bipartisan spending package. However, when after filing it, she said that, you know, I filed a motion to vacate today, but it's more of a warning than a pink slip, right? So this is not a privileged motion. which means she can make it privileged at any time. And when she does, the House has to take it up within 2 legislative days. Right now, it's just sitting there. Nothing's going to happen. But she's saying, too, it's time for us to go through the process, take our time, and find a new Speaker of the House that will stand with Republicans and our Republican majority instead of standing with Democrats. And she has said that she will bring the vote up if Johnson attempts to pass Ukraine aid, which we'll get to in a minute, because I think he's going to bring Ukraine aid to the floor. He's not going to be bullied or threatened by her. But 2 other things happen after this on Friday, which were also very surprising. We had talked about this about a week or two before, that Congressman Mike Gallagher, who chairs the China Select Committee and also the Cyber Subcommittee on Armed Services, said he was not going to run for re-election. He then stunned everybody on Friday, saying he's going to resign from Congress effective April 19th. So in about less than 4 weeks, Mike Gallagher is going to be gone, which, one, is a huge loss to Congress, but 2, it means the Republican majority now is down to 1 person, right, instead of 2. So the majority continues to shrink. Then after that, Kay Granger, the powerful chair of the House Appropriations Committee, announced that she would be stepping down as chair of the Appropriations Committee now that the minibus has passed, and will serve as chair emeritus for the rest of the year. She will serve out her term in Congress, but now that opens up a race for chairman of Appropriations, which will be between Congressman Tom Cole and Congressman Robert Aderholt, who are both members of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. I believe that Tom Cole will win this running away. So he will be the next chair of the Appropriations Committee. Now, you asked about the supplemental. Johnson has made it clear that he is going to put something on the floor. Now, what that something is unclear. And, you know, he and Zelensky did speak apparently today. Zelensky tweeted that he had spoke with Johnson. He thanked him and the American people and Biden for their support for Ukraine. He briefed Johnson on the battlefield situation. He told him that quick passage of Ukraine of aid to Ukraine by Congress is vital. But he said something really smart. He actually said, "We recognize that there are differing views in the House of Representatives on how to proceed. But the key is to keep the issue of aid to Ukraine as a unifying factor." Now, Johnson's got several options, right? And one is the bill that already passed the Senate. I've said before, I think that's the best option. The Democrats I've talked to have made it clear to me that they, if Johnson puts the Senate bill on the floor, they will protect him on a motion to vacate. All right. Now, the problem with the Senate bill for Johnson is he's already spent a lot of time trashing it. 2, it contains humanitarian aid for Gaza, which many Republicans are against. Now, even though he would get protected on a motion to vacate, you know, and Johnson's not a survivalist. I've said this. He's not, you know, he's not like Kevin McCarthy. He's going to do what he thinks is right. However, his staff, they're survivalists. They want to keep their jobs. And they're going to worry that if Johnson does put the Senate bill on the floor, he does survive a motion to vacate. At the end of the year, he won't be speaker if the Republicans keep majority, because then he won't be able to get 218 votes within his conference to elect him as speaker. So I think there's going to be a, you know, push and pull on whether to put the Senate bill on the floor. Now, he could put his own plan on the floor, which we've talked about before, which include things like loan, lend-lease formula for weapon sales. Although he's talked about linking Ukraine aid to overturning some of Biden's energy policies, including the ban on new LNG, liquid natural gas export approvals. I think it's a non-starter with Democrats. He still could separate the two into a Ukraine and Taiwan package. There's still now remember the Senate bill too, there's a discharge petition on that. That is now up to 191 signatures. There's the Fitzpatrick Golden Bacon bipartisan bill, which we talked about before, that has, you know, these border provisions in it, like you know, stay in Mexico policy, also the loan authority, the lend lease authority, the repo act. That only has I think right now 16 signatures on a discharge petition. So, and to complicate matters further, the president's expected to send a supplemental request to Congress asking for funds to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge that was just destroyed in Baltimore, which could cost billions of dollars. And the fight's already begun over that, where some Republicans think it's outrageous that the government would pay for it. Some Republicans say they want to have offsets to that. You know, do the Democrats try to connect this to this? That makes things, you know, more complicated. But I am happy at least to see that this, the wheels continue to move. Johnson is going to put something on the floor. So the fight still continues, and there's still hope.
You nailed it, because very early on when he became speaker, you said that he knows what the right thing to do is and will get to the right thing. And I'm glad that there is at least the condominium being struck by Democrats to try to at least support a speaker who has a rancorous caucus, and he's still trying to do the right thing. Right. I think his statement that the United States has to abide by its promises was a very, very powerful message. And I'm going to get to Dove in a moment, because he is sitting in Japan. And what happens in Europe doesn't stay in Europe. It's connected. And U.S. leadership and the notion of it, everybody in the world is watching this. This is why I find the stuntery by some lawmakers to be absurdist. Everybody is looking for these signs. This goes well beyond Ukraine. The administration was right that this is really about China, and it's all interconnected. Just one quick question before I go to Dove. How long? I mean, Ukraine is getting pounded. Vladimir Putin is blaming the Ukrainians, not ISIS-K, or sort of blaming ISIS-K, but saying the Ukrainians really are behind this, you know, absurd as this that is. But he's trying to, you know, double down, increase attacks, and then I think justify a mobilization in Russia, which is very politically fraught, unless you can make the case the Ukrainians now are sending Central Asians to kill us here, right? What's the time scale? Because Ukraine is close to running on empty, and the sooner the money that gets, the sooner the better for the money. Is this an April vote and it's resolved by April? Right? Some senior folks have told me we can try to get this done, you know, around the first quarter or early into the second quarter. Where is this? How's this going to play out time-wise? Or is this an August event, in which case that's not good?
It's not an August event because they're not here in August. So look, no one knows. I talked to the leadership, both Democrat and Republican this week. They're out of session this week. They're out of session next week. My guess is I think this is an April vote in the House, all right? And I don't think it's the first week they get back, only because we don't know what we're voting on yet. The only thing that they could vote on would be the Senate bill that week. The other legislation is just not drafted yet. So I think that it's an April vote in the House. If it's not the Senate bill, we have to see what the Senate does or what the House does. You know, is the Senate going to pick up what the House passes and pass it, or are they going to modify it as well? So I think optimistically that this could get wrapped up in May.
From your mouth to God's ears, as the saying goes. And I used August because I think once upon a time, you know, you'd said that it could be after August, right? So it was after recess. So I apologize for using that date, even though, you know, after this hard work that members are putting in, they're going to need a pause. And they're also going to have to run for office.
Well, I had mentioned on an earlier podcast, I talked to a friend on defense appropriations back in February who had said it could take 4 months. Right. So May is close to 4 months from when we had that discussion.
Right. So I hope so. Dove, you're in Japan and joining us very early in the morning, for which we're very appreciative. How is all of this playing in Japan with some of the meetings you're having with both senior Japanese, but also prominent Americans in Japan?
Well, I was just in Singapore before I got here to Tokyo, and I want to point out something that they were saying out there that I think is interesting, which was, don't sell yourselves short. All of Southeast Asia, and Patrick can confirm that, really is deep. You know, on the one hand, they're deeply concerned about China and they're strengthening their links with us. On the other hand, they're very nervous about our own internal madness. And that was the phrase that I heard. Don't sell yourselves short. They can't afford for us to sell ourselves short. With Japan, there's a very, very different kind of problem. In addition to their concerns about us, they're moving ahead with their defense spending. Patrick has talked about that. But this is a country, and by the way, Singapore is not all that different, that is aging. Right. And what happens when you're aging is your tax base declines. Now, in the case of Japan, they're trying to get to 2% in 5 years. They'll probably do it. But if your tax base is declining and you've got to spend more money on healthcare, and they're already spending more than they were several years ago, and they'll have to spend even more, how are you going to fund defense and the healthcare? The problems that we have are not all that different from the problems that they have in terms of budget allocation. So the combination of that, plus the concerns about the shenanigans in Washington, doesn't make them feel all that comfortable. But on the other hand, they're going to keep pushing ahead. And pretty soon, in some 5 years, they'll have the third largest defense budget in the world.
Has the the potential of abandonment by Trump this time around, or at least the withdrawal of American troops, right? I mean, it's been said that the president in his second term would look to reduce American troops and support for NATO, withdraw American troops from Japan, withdraw American troops from Korea. Patrick has said that that might be more of a negotiating or extortion position, depending on how you look at it. Whereas for some, you know, are saying, look, I mean, we have to take that seriously, and it may not be a negotiating position. Right. Donald Trump has made clear he doesn't want to fight for Taiwan, however good Taiwan's case.
Well, there are two things here. One is fighting for Taiwan. And what I was hearing was, you know, there's a sense that the Chinese aren't going to invade Taiwan. They don't need to. The real question becomes, do they impose a blockade? And does Trump basically say, hey, I don't want to take this on? And someone said to me, if there's a blockade, it's kind of hard to do a Berlin airlift for an entire population, not just one city, and to sustain it over and over again. So there's that question. But Patrick, I think, is right, because the truth of the matter is no one knows what Donald Trump would do, because Donald Trump doesn't know what he would do. Is he going to be more hostile to China, and that'll lead him to keeping the troops in East Asia? Will he be less hostile to China? Nobody knows. He doesn't know. And he may be negotiating. So it's just a huge question mark, which further complicates everything I was talking about a couple of seconds ago.
This is kind of a good opportunity to go to Patrick. So, Jim, just bear with us for a minute. Patrick, your sense on how all of this is being received in the region, right? I mean, I would point out, we're talking about a potential agreement, assuming everything goes to plan, and we end up getting the money, right? It doesn't matter until the money is actually sitting there in Ukraine and being used to good effect by the Ukrainians. But your sense on how all of this is playing out, I would also point out that there was some interesting language in this and authorizations, appropriations, in terms of capabilities to underwrite, right, in the Indo-Pacific as part of the Indo-Pacific or part of the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, right? Some good money that Indo-Pacific commanders have been asking for a long time to sort of build up capabilities is in this measure as well, and that's welcome. Just give us your sense on the messaging and the optics of all of this, and then we'll get to the specific news in the region in just a moment.
Yeah, there's so many ways to touch this elephant. I wrote an essay in the Korean newspaper this week on the good news that the three leading officials, Aquilino, LaCamera, and Eli Ratner's testimony last week on the posture statement, have a lot of good news to tell about how we've strengthened our alliance posture, and we're basically walking and chewing gum, and this is good news. But wait for our election, wait for what else comes in internationally, because a lot could disrupt our plans, and it may not be sufficient. And that's sort of the uncertainty that is gnawing at all of our allies and partners in the region. And this continues to be a subject of every discussion with every Asian capital. I'm reading an interesting interview from John Bolton in Asia Nikkei today, where he's talking about, you know, Trump, left to his own devices, sees things like the U.S.-Japan alliance and U.S.-Korea alliance as a real estate deal. But he's going to probably press Japan, if he's back in office, to change Article 5 of the security treaty and say it's got to be reciprocal. That, of course, opens up a lot of debate, including what does Japan do with its constitution, because it's no longer just a legal issue of kind of bending the rules. The Korean issue, whether they go nuclear or need to go nuclear because of the pressure that might be on them. Sure, they see...
Well, the same would be true for Japan, right? I mean, you
absolutely
could argue, and if Japan feels that sense of abandonment, that 1977 effective development of the bomb and then dismantling it comes back, doesn't it?
As soon as you introduce sort of unpredictability about the U.S. alliance, you open up in Seoul, in Tokyo, the need for desperate measures. And therefore, nuclear issues have to be back into the national security discussion in both of those capitals. That's just the reality. That's going to happen if we're that unpredictable. Same thing as if we lose the war in Ukraine. If that's lost, there's going to be a lot of concern about American staying power. And right now, the fact that Putin has just stuck us, at the UN Security Council with a veto of basically effectively ending monitoring of North Korean sanctions is a way of saying, hey, the revisionist powers are going strong. Let's press forward. America's distracted, has an election, has a lot of challenges. We think we're doing well. And so with China and North Korea and other countries, Iran, they think this is a moment. And I think our allies are watching this very closely, and it's going to be a fraught year. There's no doubt.
I think that it's also interesting that Mike Johnson's public support for the supplemental came after Vladimir Putin is trying to pin the ISIS-K attack in Moscow on the Ukrainians, ultimately, to try to justify again, whether it's a mobilization or more, quote, extreme measures in how they fight the Ukrainians. Jim, you're in Paris. Ukrainians and many others have been making the case about the urgency with which these funds are needed, and also the message that it sends our European allies and partners who are stepping up. I think Emmanuel Macron is doing a terrific job in terms of framing some of these issues. And again, we're self-deterring. When Emmanuel Macron says we should be open to sending troops to a sovereign nation as sovereign nations, we shouldn't be throwing cold water on that. It's important to have a degree of ambiguity, or to have a whole bunch of people saying we're fully entitled. We could send 50,000 troops there today if we wanted to, would be the right message, because you're then sending a wrong message to Putin. Well, talk to us a little bit about your sense on, how the events in Washington are being perceived as we get closer, hopefully, to getting that supplemental. But then how Europeans are registering the message of blaming the Ukrainians on a terror attack that's made all the worse, given the United States gave the Russians warning that ISIS-K is going to attack Moscow in a big public space. Okay, so one would have assumed there might be a little bit heightened security in some of these places. Maybe they were too busy arresting, 80-year-old pensioners on the street for putting flowers on Navalny's grave, which appears to be more sort of how they use their manpower. What's your sense, and what are you picking up from Paris on these points?
Well, my sense, and it's not just France, but it's in a number of capitals in Europe, is that this idea that the U.S. Might not be as engaged as it has been in the past, that's almost an accepted course of events. And this basically either is because Trump is elected, or it's because we're overstretched and we're going to have to do a pivot to Asia, if you will, and that pivot will be at the expense of U.S. force posture in Europe. And so there is an acceptance now growing that this idea of a European pillar at NATO, of the Europeans filling the gaps that the U.S. might leave, this is becoming a very real thing. And it's certainly, the French are talking about it. The Germans are too. The Germans are having a bit more of a struggle, but they're making progress in terms of understanding the burdens that are on them to step up. And not that they haven't stepped up, but that they're going to have to be talking this idea of increasing forces, numbers of forces. There's talk about, do we need to have some type of draft that begins in Europe and some European countries? I mean, this getting to be very serious talk, and not just in the capitals, but also on the street. And here, when I talk to people in Paris, and they hear that that I'm from the U.S. and what my background is, the first thing they ask is there going to be a war? When will this happen? Will France be invaded? It's on the top of their minds here. So all of this has certainly prepared many Europeans for the idea that there could be a war in Europe. They just don't know when or how, and they're a bit confused, but they know that things have gotten serious.
Before we continue, a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. You were saying last week, right, that there is a bit of war fever, right? You went to your toy soldier shop and sort of the sense that people are not spending money, they're squirreling it away, which is what Europeans have a tendency of doing when they see dark clouds approaching. And God knows they've had some experience on that front, albeit not for the last several decades. Let me take you, Jim, to the subsequent question, right? Sweden's well-respected and unfortunately a very senior German parliamentarian who's on the Foreign Affairs Committee, you sent me an article about him, has finally decided after nearly three decades in the Bundestag to call it quits. And unfortunately, that's the kind of talent that we can't afford to be losing now in Europe. Sweden's well-respected foreign minister, Tobias Billström, said that we all need to be a lot tougher on Russia and presented with a lot more strategic problems. In France, there's a lot of criticism of the nation's defense and European defense industry for not stepping up capabilities fast enough. What are some of the things that thoughtful people are talking about, right? Billström would be one of them, to present more strategic problems for the Russians, you know, in the absence before more ammunition shows up, right? I think we can all do better on sanctions. The sanctions were tightened, but wealthy Russians are still, you know, literally gallivanting around Europe, flaunting sanctions, right? Their spouses might be sanctioned, but the families are still enjoying their place in Kosovo. What does this next step, do you think, need to look like to make life more difficult for the Russians?
Well, just a couple of things real quick on the German parliamentarian. What was worrisome about that particularly is that he left because he felt that his pro-Europe, we've got to get stronger here in Germany with our military, et cetera. That view was no longer, he felt that he was no longer being listened to. And this is a German problem where in Germany there is still an unwillingness to seize the moment and the importance for Germany of being a major engine in Europe to develop these capabilities to deter Russia. And there's still, I was talking to some Germans a few days ago, it still really hasn't penetrated the minds of a lot of Germans where we are. And Scholz isn't making things any easier. But that's the significance of that member of Parliament. Not only was he someone needed, but he just gave up and threw his hands up and said, "I'm out of here. I'm done. They're not listening to me." And one thing just to say that was I found very interesting was that here the Minister of Defense in France has warned French defense industry that the French government will begin to do what we have. We have this capability the administration does to order U.S. Businesses to prioritize national defense capability and production, and they can do that in France too. And the Minister of Defense has just warned over the past day or so French industry that if they don't move fast enough on military priorities, that the government's going to step in and do it for them. And so it's and I say this because it is, you don't expect this from France, and you don't expect what the Swedish foreign minister necessarily said either. You know, the Swedes are very blunt on this stuff. Their heads are not in the sand on this. They are very out in front, making sure the Swedish people know that there is trouble ahead. They joined NATO, of course, which helped make that case. And here the foreign minister is coming out and warning the rest of Europe, we've got to get serious and provide strategic problems for, as you point out, strategic problems for the Russians. What those could look like is anybody's guess. It's something that the European Union can certainly do. There's things that can be done politically, but I think the Swedes are talking about something more than that. Maybe something in their neighborhood, the Nordic neighborhood, maybe in the Baltic Sea. Maybe there's big exercises that are going to be done, or there's disinformation campaigns that go into Russia. I mean, there's things they can do. But the point is that the Swedes themselves are coming out at the foreign ministers level saying this. And remember, the NATO foreign ministers are going to meet in a couple of days in Brussels to talk about all this. So, you know, it's just every day when you read the press here, there's something else indicating how serious these governments are.
And I should have said it's Michael Roth is who we're talking about, SPD member, and Sebastian Lecornu, obviously being the Armed Forces Minister of France. Let me just ask parenthetically one little question, and Patrick, I'm going to come to you in a moment. But is there any heightened concern about terrorism in Europe in the wake of the ISIS-K attack in Moscow? ultimately, yeah. Right? I mean, we have a tendency of sort of thinking, okay, it's all great power competition. It's China, Russia, North Korea. And then, you know, this is still a problem. And, you know, there are those who are worried about what radicalization looks like, rightly, wrongly, badly, whatever, in the wake of the Gaza campaign, that, you know, either people will be motivated by what happened on October 7 or be motivated by the response in the wake of October 7 that could then precipitate bigger problems downstream. Are folks devoting any bandwidth to the return of terrorism and the price of that?
Well, the French certainly are, because, you know, they have the Olympics coming up. And so they are feeling particularly vulnerable if ISIS-K or other branches of ISIS are on the march suddenly, that things have gotten even hotter in terms of counterterrorism for the Olympics. So you see now there's police, that's just a police presence, and where there's large gatherings at Luxembourg Gardens, if you're familiar with Paris.
Right.
I noticed there were cops there, and I went over by Notre Dame today, and the tourists on Easter time pack Paris. And so I was thinking this is just a nice big soft target for ISIS-K. And I'm sure that the French are thinking the same thing. So for sure the French do. The Italians raised the alert level like the French did. The Italians did the same thing because of the tourist sites there. So yeah, I think it is being it is taken on board, particularly in France, but it has to share the stage with what's happening in Ukraine.
Right.
Absolutely share the stage there.
Indeed. Dov, very briefly, do you think that we're paying enough attention to the prospect of terrorism, as somebody who was part of the senior defense leadership on 9/11 and onward in sort of the beginning of the global war on terror, which we've done a great job keeping security. But the thing is, we've got to be right 100% of the time, and they've got to be right only a handful of times to be disruptive.
Well, I mean, clearly we're not talking about it anywhere near as much as we used to. I think look, we didn't have a Department of Homeland Security when 9/11 happened. We have one now. It even got funded, as Mike would tell us. So I think we have more capability to deal with this. And certainly the alert levels are up. However, and I think this is the key point, it is not something that the public worries about, say, the way they did after 9/11 and for quite a few years afterwards. So I think the public awareness in Europe, I think, is probably higher. Jim can correct me on that. And secondly, we are being diverted by a lot of other things. I mean, we had a war on terror for 20 years, and that's all we focused on. But you heard Patrick, you've heard Jim. We're still involved, heavily involved in the Middle East. We've got a lot of other things on our plate, and that makes it more difficult, I think, not so much for the specific agencies that worry about terrorism, but for the coordination and getting others in the government's attention, as perhaps they did, previously, when really the war on terror was the only focus we had.
Indeed. And again, we've gotten so good in a lot of respects in improving our security and obviously the national and international terrorism apparatus, that we're able to give allies and partners and even adversaries warning, you're about to get hit, heads up. So it's really interesting to see, you know, what sort of counterterrorism cooperation looks like going forward, because obviously the Russians are going to have to, even if they're pinning this on Kyiv, going to have to respond at some point.
But the one thing, Vago, that you said, and I think is correct, is it only takes one incident. And look, the Russians have clearly been concerned about terrorism. That didn't go away, partly because of the war and what the Ukrainians were doing inside Russia. It just takes one incident. And right. And then you'll see a massive reaction.
Patrick, be patient. We're going to get to the Asia part of the discussion in just a second, but I really have to ask Jim in 30 seconds, a Russian missile spent, 39 seconds or whatever it is, over Polish territory. The Poles have demanded the Russians explain themselves. The Russian answer, an extraordinary answer, although nothing's extraordinary coming from Russians, is we have nothing really to say, and kind of two fingers And Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, who basically is going to make this call, you know, is like, hey, we've got to bounce the ambassador, expel him. What does this sort of tell us, right? I mean, because the Russians, this, you know, it could have been an accident, but pretty much the Russians always are trying to make a point, right? Your territory is porous, for example.
Well, I think, you know, it's so, for me, it's not so much what happened, you know, the 30 seconds, and this is just one more example of brick by brick tensions rising in Europe. This kind of act where the Russians flip off the Poles and the Poles are furious, it ratchets things up between Poland and Russia. You know, We have to know that a scenario could be conflict breaks out, not because the Russians invade Estonia, but because the Poles whack out at the Russians because they've been taunted so much. They have, you know, that the relationship between the two has gotten so bad, the Poles can't stand it anymore. And you have an incident and then another incident. And pretty soon you've got a localized conflict between Poland and Russia, and that's NATO. And I mean, so that kind of thing can happen too. You know, we almost have to hold the Poles back, you know, from lurching at the Russians. So it's just one of these things that if you look at history at the months and weeks before conflict breaks out, these are the kinds of things that ratchet up nations and get their backs up, and it can result in conflict. And when I read that, I just said, God, this could be like, what, 1939? You know, this could be April 1939. This is the kind of thing where you have conflict that builds and builds and builds, and these little things are what builds that conflict.
I will tell you that, you know, Poland has zero patience left for Russia's behavior, because, again, in Vladimir Putin's mind, parts of Poland deserve to be part of Russia, and the Poles are going to have no part of a you know, the fourth partition of Poland at the hands of the Russians and interference.
Yeah. Also, Radek Sikorski is known to trifle with. Radek he is a very forward-leaning foreign minister. I'm a great fan of his, and I've worked with him in years past. But he is not someone that you trifle with. He's going to do something. He's not going to sit back and tell the Russians, "Well, okay, well, next time, be careful." Well, you know, something's going to happen.
I agree. And neither is Tusk nor the chief of generals. Right. I mean, they have a very serious approach to this. Patrick, you've been very patient obviously a big week in Asia. Any just top line points? I mean, we had everybody take a bite on the terror question. But, you know, is that heightening any tensions, do you think, in Asia, which has tended to either have some, you know, devastating attacks, certainly in places like Indonesia and elsewhere. But any sort of sense on whether or not this attack in Moscow is elevating tensions, or are folks looking at this and saying, okay, you know, Russia was involved and particularly brutal in the way that it was prosecuting its campaigns, and, you know, guys attack Moscow. Assuming Moscow didn't pay these guys to attack it, right? I mean, I don't want to. Conspiracy theorist at all, but Putin has been known to cause domestic incidents that he could capitalize on.
Well, let me begin with what seems most obvious to me, which is that the great power competition and tension is clearly impeding great power cooperation on an issue on which we've had cooperation in the past. So just as we tried to warn Russia, Russia's sort of blowing this back at us and support for Ukraine. The Chinese, meanwhile, they just had a convoy of engineers blown up in Pakistan. They had Houthi rebels actually attack a Chinese-owned and operated cargo vessel in the Red Sea against their sort of gentleman's agreement. And yet that's not an area that we seem to be about to cooperate. In fact, if anything, it's driving Russia and China toward closer cooperation. So where this plays out in the global south, so-called, we'll have to wait and see. But right now, it's an area of competition. and confrontation, not the cooperation, that third C that the Biden administration has said, look, we can cooperate even while we confront and compete. Well, it turns out on an issue we used to cooperate on, it's not so easy.
Thanks very much for pointing out all of those examples. Let's shift gears, right? So on the one hand, China is waging increasing tensions with everybody, waging cyber campaigns across the United States and around the world, targeting American companies, including the nation's most high-tech ones. And at the same time, U.S. CEOs were in Beijing being feted by Xi Jinping. And this as China is stepping up coercive operations against the Philippines just at the instant that Washington and Manila were striking a new security pact, right? How do we interpret this ultimately?
This is not like the old Cold War. You know, it's very tough to try to compete with China and take them on where they are trying to revise the international system and at the same time try to find areas to cooperate so that we don't create World War III. And I think that's sort of the big picture. Those people who want to completely decouple with China, well, sorry, there's still too much interdependence. And those who want to cooperate with China, I'm sorry, there's still too many conflicts with China to ignore them. So we had Treasury Secretary Yellen going down to Norcross, Georgia, at the Suniva plant, which is the largest crystalline solar cell manufacturer in the Western Hemisphere. It went bankrupt in 2017 because of the flooding of the market with Chinese subsidized solar panels, EVs, lithium-ion batteries. And she says, look, we've got these tax credits through the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's reviving our industry and manufacturing in this area. We'll see. But she says she's going to take that message to Beijing in Guangzhou when she goes there next week to take on the Chinese. But they're not really going to listen to that. You know, the Chinese are doing exactly what Xi Jinping did, which is he's feting American CEOs, Blackstone and Qualcomm and Chubb and all these others who want to do business with China. And right. He knows his audience. It's the same reason. And by the way, Steve Orleans, who's the president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, one of the two big groups sort of backing this trip, you know, put in social media that we were all deeply impressed and recommitted to building a cooperative U.S.-China relationship. So that's a significant voice of the business community, should not be ignored by the national security community. Meanwhile, the Chinese are also just lifting the enormous tariffs they had placed 3 years ago on Australian wine. And so, you know, suddenly you've got Chinese looking at sipping Southern Australian Shiraz again. And that's important because China is choosing its targets carefully. It's trying to ease tensions right. with a key American ally on this sort of anniversary of AUKUS with the Australians. And we'll see how far that goes. But they're playing both good and bad cop. And meanwhile, we're revealing new things about APT-31 and the hacking that's gone on. It's been malicious, you know, against officials, journalists, think tanks, the finance, secret financing that they're doing, including in Sri Lanka, once again, to try to extend Chinese influence in the capital there, and the geopolitical jockeying that's going on, including at the Huaobo Forum, their Davos Forum, where you had Zhao Laji, who's the number three on the Politburo, talking about the global security initiative and saying we've got to stop this sort of American-led thinking of Cold War mentality. And they're doing that even while they're shouldering and water cannoning Filipino ships, you know, yet right. again in the South China Sea. So we're living in a world where we have heightened tensions and yet still a need for commercial sort of interaction.
Let me take you to the big summit that's going to be coming up. The United States brokered an entente between Tokyo and Seoul, and with the United States as part of that Three Amigos deal, which is instrumental and a bedrock for stability in the Indo-Pacific. What do you expect from this summit? Because as we were preparing for this, you used the term muscular in defining it. Walk us through what we should expect from that.
Right. Let me clarify this too. I mean, so one of the summits that's coming up is actually, first of all, Prime Minister Kishida meeting with President Biden. And this will be one of two trips he'll be making. He'll be back in July for the NATO summit. And yet he's still expected to have to step down in September. He's polling in the sort of in the teens and is likely to step aside to bring around not a loss of continuity in policy, but maybe a different leader. Anyway, they're on the cusp of announcing a new almost joint command. And that's, they're not going to announce it. What they're going to do, though, is they're going to hint that by next March, which is when Japan has to set up what they've promised, which is a joint headquarters for all of their forces, something they've never had, that has to lash up with U.S. forces in Japan, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, but also U.S. forces in Korea and what's going on between Korea, Japan, and the United States. So the three countries are working on a new, not just wiring diagram, but something that allows much more operational capabilities in Japan. Japan wants to be have a leading edge on this. So it's complicated, but they'll probably announce a joint patrol, which is one of the stories that came out in the Financial Times. We'll have to wait and see. And at the same time, the summit that is actually happening after that is President Marcos is joining Prime Minister Kishida and President Biden at the White House on the 11th of April. And there they'll talk about yet more muscular action in the South China Sea. And they have been giving strong support for President Marcos, who vowed this week not to step down and not to let the Chinese blow the Philippines out of the water here. There's a 50-50 chance we will have a military confrontation between the Philippines, the United States, and China this year. And that's because China does not want to see the Philippines essentially implement their archipelagic defense concept, something they've been talking about rather vaguely, but they've got a classified plan in place. And that's what's been discussed in closed doors, including by the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, who just went through Manila this week, and discussed, no doubt, between Secretary Austin and his counterpart on the phone, when Secretary Austin once again reaffirmed the American commitment to protect Philippine ships and assets, even while at the Second Thomas Shoal or at T2 Island or at the Scarborough Shoal, you have these various flashpoints that the Chinese are pressing upon on the Chinese.
I think it's extraordinary. And again, this is how conflicts begin. Let me shift to Dove, who has been giving us his guidance on this issue many months after your Dove. First proposed the U.S. changing its vote in the Security Council to try to shape Israeli behavior. Washington last week abstained on a call for an immediate ceasefire. That was while Defense Minister Yoav Gallant was in Washington to discuss the Rafah offensive, among other things. The vote prompted Bibi to order Israeli officials to call off talks with their American counterparts and canceled his own U.S. visit. Bibi has vowed that the invasion of Rafah is going to go ahead, even though Biden has said that that's a red line. And indeed, operations really have been picking up across Gaza, but around Rafah in particular, and indeed in the West Bank, where fatalities have been mounting. And again, an exchange of fire deadly on both sides on the northern border. Again, I think Israel is going to do whatever it wants to do, how it wants to do it, irrespective of the repercussions, expecting the repercussions really aren't going to be that bad, ultimately. How is this week different from others? What does this tell us about, you know, what's next? What jumped out at you?
Well, a couple of things. First, Bibi relented just yesterday, and he's sending his two delegates to Washington. Gallant, when he was here, tried to smooth over the mini crisis over these guys coming. But as I mentioned last week, when you have the leader, a leader of the settlement movement, Hanegbi, who is now national security advisor and opposed the Gaza withdrawal in 2005, which means he's not exactly opposed to going back into Gaza and staying there. And then you have Ron Dermer, whose primary role as he may be the strategic affairs minister or whatever he calls him, or whatever they call him, but he's basically Bibi's brain and political advisor, and he wants to keep that coalition together. He can't do that if they give any kind of concession at all on Gaza, because the right wing will bolt. And so don't expect anything from these guys coming here anyway. To me, the big question mark that's going to be resolved in a week is what happens to the ultra-Orthodox who are opposing essentially the death of the draft law that exempted 66,000 of their students from serving in the military. That law really ended a while ago, but the Supreme Court said, the Israeli Supreme Court, that if they do not come up with a replacement by March 31st, April 1st, then all these 66,000 students are eligible for the draft. The religious parties are furious. They are threatening to bolt. They mean it. And Bibi has been desperately trying to somehow keep them on board. And his problem is that the very same right wingers who support him on Gaza oppose him on letting all these people be exempted at a time when they're raising the age of reservists who are in any event needed to keep the economy going. And the military leadership, as well as Benny Gantz, the senior opposition leader who joined the government, all oppose any kind of concession to the ultra-Orthodox now. So on top of the crisis with Washington and the question of what to do in Gaza, this government could collapse next week. I'm not saying it will, but I think there's a very, very strong possibility that it might, which is something that is a nightmare for Bibi and leaves everything up in the air if it actually happens.
But even if Bibi is not sitting in the seat, does this change the vector and the arc of the Israeli campaign, whether in Gaza or the actions, unfortunately, counterproductive actions that the government is also taking in the West Bank? I mean, they announced more housing settlements, for example, right?
Well,
it's not the right best time to do this.
Again, the announcement of housing settlements was made by Smotrich, the finance minister and one of the far right ministers. And he would go if the government collapsed. I mean, there's one other factor that's very, very important here. The Israelis had to go back into Al-Shifa Hospital and root out some more Hamas people, and they thought they'd cleared it out. And that is shades of what happened to us in Afghanistan. Every time we cleared out a Taliban village and left, the Taliban came right back. It's shades of Vietnam. It shows that you can't really clean them all out unless you kick everyone out, and that's not going to happen. If Gantz becomes prime minister, for a start, there'll be a change in the relationship with Washington, number one, because it's right now it's terrible. And number two, he will probably be more inclined to listen to what the military is saying as opposed to what is right now a politically driven campaign.
Okay, before we wrap up, Michael, we're coming back to you around the horn. So if there's anything you want to weigh in on terrorism or anything else, you're welcome to. But give us kind of the political sense, and then we will have a remembrance briefly of Joe Lieberman. We're already long on this show, so I apologize to the audience, but there was a lot for us to chew on here. Walk us through on the impeachment, the Trump takeover of the Republican National Committee and the aftermath of that, and any other political point, because it was funny in preparing for this, you said RFK Jr. and his new running mate, Nicole Shanahan, who I think potentially changes the game. She's articulate, has got a lot of money. You know, I find it interesting the amount of Republican money that's going to RFK, which is brilliant, seeing as how he seems to be getting 70% of his support from Biden voters. That's interesting. But walk us through what you thought was important this week on the political front.
Sure. So we haven't talked about impeachment in a while. And when there's two impeachments we got to talk about, and it'll be very brief. But remember, when the House impeached Mayorkas, they never sent the articles of impeachment over to the Senate to begin the process. Right. Mike Johnson has announced that he's going to send those articles over on April 10th. And Schumer has indicated that on April 11th, he's going to swear in the Senate as jurors. Now, I would expect also on the 11th that there would be a motion to table, and this would be the end of that. Johnson's already come out saying that he hopes that that's not what they do, but that will waste some time in the Senate. Now, as far as the Biden impeachment goes, you know, the House Republicans had a hearing last Wednesday, which, again, did not yield any major developments in their investigation and no smoking gun. And in fact, Jared Moskowitz, who's a Democrat on that committee, said, hey, let's go ahead. Let's go forth impeachment. Somebody put forward a motion and I'll second it. Of course, no one did because they know they don't have the votes. But today, Congressman Comer, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, sent a 7-page letter to Biden again, accusing him of impropriety and inviting him to testify before their committee, which, of course, he is not going to do. Now, Comer has indicated that impeachment vote against Biden may not be the best path because they know they don't have the votes to do it. But instead, they're thinking about criminal referrals to the Department of Justice. And this is going to be key because this is going to hang over our heads for a while, because obviously Garland's Department of Justice is not going to do anything with those criminal referrals. But if Donald Trump became president next year, I would expect him to press his attorney general to follow those criminal referrals and to go after Biden criminally as payback for what he would think is payback for what he has been now going through. So this is going to continue, could continue well beyond the Biden presidency. Now, Trump's takeover of the RNC continues to progress. We know his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, is now the co-chair. They let go the staff of the RNC and are making them reapply for their jobs. But one of the critical interview questions is, during the interview, you have to ask whether you believe the 2020 election was stolen. So these are the kind of people that they're going to be putting in charge of the RNC. Now, at the same time,
there's only one right answer to that, right?
Exactly. There is only one right answer to that. So hopefully they are unable to hire staff. But, you know,
I'm going to bet you there are going to be enough people who are going to, you know, Stalin was able to fill a lot of jobs, too. And he was the greatest leader ever, as we know.
I know. Wishful thinking. All right. But they will be able to build out a staff there. But, you know, it's actually, you know, in some respects hurting Trump's campaign because his infrastructure is really lagging behind schedule. And the RNC is not making any real significant investments in key battleground states. For example, in Michigan, the party chairman there said they haven't transferred any money. There's no specific programs in place to court voters of color, and there's no general election field staff in place. And in fact, they've actually rolled back plans from previous RNC leaders to add hundreds of staff to do minority outreach in key states like Michigan, which are battleground states. So, you know, look, I still have some optimism. Look, I think you're right about Nicole Shanahan now being named as RFK's VP, because she has tremendous wealth to draw upon. And by raising money and by trying to get themselves on ballots in key states, they really could be a spoiler. Those voters are going to come from Biden and not going to come from Trump. We've talked previously that 97% of the people who voted for Trump in 2020 say they're voting for him again in 2024. However, I think the no labels ticket seems to be fizzling, which is a good sign for Biden. As I thought, Chris Christie was the one they wanted. Chris Christie was interested in it. He spent weeks doing polling, looking at the map, calculating a budget. No labels thought he would be the candidate up until a couple days ago. He knows there's no path forward, so he is withdrawing. So it's very possible No Labels does not have a candidate. But Biden's still going to have to contend with not only RFK's candidacy, but also Cornel West and Jill Stein. And in those battleground states, those can make the difference.
Arizona was 10,000 votes, right? So all you need is some to stay home, some to be turned off, and some to decide, I just can't bring myself to doing this. In 10 seconds, does Barack Obama campaigning on behalf of Joe Biden change the dynamic, considering how effective a campaigner Barack Obama can be?
Yes, I think it does. And it also helps him raise money. They just announced the largest haul ever for a fundraiser in the history of politics, $25 million they're raising at an event in New York with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. It's all hands on deck, and they will have a lot more resources than Donald Trump and his folks will have. Because remember, a lot of the resources that Trump's going to raise are going to go to pay for his criminal defense as much as possible. So it ain't over yet.
And whichever one of you wants to take this, either Michael or Dove, or maybe both of you or everybody, very briefly, and unfortunately, we don't have as much time to discuss this, but Joe Lieberman's untimely passing, a centrist Democrat, liberal, socially hawkish, militarily prudent, fiscally. Right. I mean, the kind of, you know, he would either be a, you know, it could be a very middle of the road Republican, and indeed ran as an independent, was reelected after he was sort of cast out of the party for his support for the Iraq vote, Iraq war. And then in 2008 raised eyebrows because, you know, he backed his dear close friend, John McCain, and John McCain subsequently admitted, instead of picking Sarah Palin, if I had picked Joe Lieberman, I would have gotten elected. Reminiscences on the man. Michael, if you want to start, and Dove, bring us home.
Sure. Look, Joe Lieberman was obviously a very strong supporter of national security as a member of the Armed Services Committee. He also played a critical role in keeping Naval Submarine Base New London off the BRAC list back in 2005. He was instrumental in creating the Department of Homeland Security. And there was a reason he was Al Gore's vice presidential nominee, because you know, the Democratic Party was hurting at the time of the during the Monica Lewinsky scandal and needed somebody who was squeaky clean and moral to be the vice presidential nominee. And that was Joe Lieberman. And, you know, he did run as independent and win in 2006 and did speak at the Republican convention. But again, that's goes to speak to his character as being a bipartisan guy. He was one of the founders of No Labels. But he was a decent, good man. I'll tell you two quick stories. I mean, my wife worked on the Hill and the Senate for over 13 and a half years. And she worked for a senator who had a reputation of being extremely difficult to work for. So bad that the Washington Post made a list of worst jobs in Washington. Working for the senator was listed under the guy who euthanizes dogs at the pound. And when she was in the elevator one day with Joe Lieberman, and Joe Lieberman struck up a conversation with her, which that's the kind of guy he was, unlike a lot of senators that don't talk to people, and asked her who she worked for. And she mentioned who she does. And he just looked at her and said, "Why?" And he was also very gracious, my wife being from Connecticut.
I could so totally see him doing
that. Exactly, right? And my wife's from Connecticut. And when we were getting married in D.C., not only did he and his office take care of our family and our friends and give them a private capital tour, but he insisted that after the tour was over that our family and our small group of friends come to his office and spend time with him and talk to him. And that's the kind of man that he was. And he's going to be sorely missed. And we need more leaders like that in Congress.
And I have to tell you, he was really always generous with his time. And you always felt like whatever he was telling you was not BS. You know, even though I had very, very limited interactions with him, although I would run into him because his tailor was not far from where I used to get coffee. And I would run into him in the mornings when he was going in to get some work done. You know, always a well put together man. Dove, last 30 seconds. You have the last word. Go ahead.
Well, of course, I knew him. He actually prayed in the same synagogue as my son Roger for a number of years. And every time I saw him, he would ask for him. But I think what Joe Lieberman meant to the American Jewish community is really beyond words. It wasn't just that he was the first Jewish American to be on a major presidential ticket. It was that he stood for morality, he stood for decency, and he stood for what American Jews think of their country. And the irony, of course, is he's passing away at a time when anti-Semitism, particularly on the campuses, is rife. And here was a man who demonstrated, and by the way, he was what he called himself was an observant Jew, kind of like what I am, and we who and whatever church you belong to, he stood up for those values. And he was widely respected for that, both by Jews and by those of other faiths, because he was ready to speak truth to power, even if the power was the president of the United States. And not too many people are able to do that or willing to do that. And he did. Yes, we've lost a very important, a truly great man.
I would agree with that. And our condolences go out to the Lieberman family and to all those who he touched in his career, whether at local politics, at national politics, and indeed internationally, where he was enormously well respected. Everybody, thanks so very much for being so generous with your time. We really appreciate it. Dove, thank you for getting up early. Jim, thank you for staying up late. Patrick, thank you for being you. And Michael, thank you for being you as well. Hope everybody has a great Easter and holiday weekend. We look forward to welcoming you back to the program on Monday, the business when we convene the business roundtable. Thanks very much, guys. Hope you all have a great weekend and a great week, and look forward to having you back on again next week. And to the audience again, hope you guys have a terrific Easter and terrific holiday weekend. Look forward to seeing you again on Monday. A quick shout out to our audience to check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavas Ships, hosted by our own Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. That program sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace. The Downlink with Laura Winter, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space, sponsored by TE Aerospace. And the Air Power podcast that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler, that is sponsored by GE Aerospace. Everybody have a great weekend. We'll see you again soon. Until then, be well.